Hi friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can find a write-up of our weekly class, along with all of the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to my dearest friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior, Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Sefer Bamidbar begins with a census of the Jewish people. This, of course, was not the first time the Jewish people were counted. Earlier in Parshas Kisisa, there was also a census. So why count the Jewish people again? Rashi explains that Hashem repeatedly counted the Jewish people in order to show his love for them. We count what is beloved. But does this really explain why the Jewish people are being counted so often? I would understand why Kate McAllister, after losing her son Kevin in two separate Home Alone movies, would constantly need to count her children, but surely there's another way for God to show how precious each and every member of the Jewish people are. The Ramban, however, suggests a different reason for the counting. The Jewish people were preparing for war. As they approached the land of Israel, the Jewish people were preparing for the wars needed to conquest the land. So Moshe counted all of the Jews of military age, those 20 years of age and older. If, in fact, the point of the census was for military preparation, this may shed light on another anomaly within our Parsha, namely the fact that the tribe of Levi, Shevet Levi, was not counted. That is explicitly said in the Torah. Ach es mate Levi lo sifkod vi es rosham lo sisa betoch b'nei Yisrael. The first chapter, 49th pasuk. Do not on any account count the tribe of Levi, Shevet Levi, or take a census of them with the rest of the Jewish people. As the Rambam famously points out, the tribe of Levi were not responsible to participate in the wars of the Jewish people. They were exempted from the biblical draft. Most famously, in that final halacha in the Rambam's laws of Hilchas, Shmita and Yovel, the Rambam extends this exemption to anyone who chooses to live as if they were a part of Shevet Levi by dedicating their entire lives to the study of Torah. Are the tribe of Levi in fact exempt from war? And what was the purpose of this exemption? To understand this, let's explore the contentious history of, you guessed it, Israel's draft exemption for those studying in yeshiva. At around 10 a.m. on October 20th, 1952, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, arrived in Bnei Brak to meet with the leader of the Haredi community in Israel, Rav Avram Yeshaya Karelitz, often referred to as the Chazon Ish, which of course was the title of his publications. The press was not allowed inside the meeting, though the meeting made headlines in Israeli newspapers. We have the cover of the Ma'ariv. Can't believe I just pronounced it Ma'ariv. That was like that was a very funny slip up. Okay, I hope everybody enjoyed that. In my email and the Substack, we have a photo of that Ma'ariv. I pronounced that correctly, that last time. Ben-Gurion had asked for the meeting in the hopes of bridging the divide between the secular, which are known as Chiloni, and the Haredi communities within Israel. What did they discuss at the meeting? Although there was no press or recording of the meeting, Professor Benjamin Brown, in his incredible Hebrew biography on the Chazon Ish, entitled The Chazon Ish, Halachas Believer and Leader of the Haredi Revolution, the book unfortunately is in Hebrew, but it is fantastic. He did an incredible job reconstructing the details of the meeting based on Ben-Gurion's diary and the account of Yitzhak Navon, who accompanied Ben-Gurion to the meeting and later served as the president of Israel. Ben-Gurion's diary, the originals can actually be found online, of course we link to that, is fairly detailed. As Chen Melul translates in his fascinating article on the National Library of Israel's blog called Librarians, it is fantastic, you should absolutely check it out. Ben-Gurion described the meeting in his diary as follows. This is a translation. Of course, we have the original diary entry if you subscribe to our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. This is what Ben-Gurion wrote about the meeting. This morning I went to Bnei Brak for a meeting with the Chazon Ish. The press thought it to be a sensational visit, and I encountered crowds along the way and around his house. A group of his followers waited outside and in the nearby rooms. Yitzhak Navon was the only one who came in with me. I asked him the question to which I have yet to receive a sufficient answer from my observant friends. We are divided in different ways. In the matter at hand, we are divided by our views of religious tradition. There are Jews like you and like me. How do we live together? How will we become a unit? Ben-Gurion pushed the Chazon Ish. How can we run a country together? Would you not admit that love of your fellow Jew should be prioritized? The Chazon Ish, however, did not agree that love of Torah and the Jewish people were competing values. Love of the Jewish people and love of Torah, the Chazon Ish explained, may seem like two separate values, but like all values, they only seem that way. When you look from a higher vantage point, you'll discover they are actually unified. There is no Jewish people without Torah, and there is no Torah without the Jewish people. For the moment, however, the Chazon Ish expected some measure of deference from the state that would ensure the preservation of the Haredi community in Israel. As Navon later recounted, the Chazon Ish presented a Talmudic analogy. In Halacha, the Chazon Ish explained, if there are two camels that are traveling together on the road, one is laden with heavy baggages and the other is not carrying anything, the camel that is carrying baggage should pass first. The Haredi community, explained the Chazon Ish, is carrying Jewish tradition, the 613 commandments, and therefore should be permitted to pass first. I believe, however, the Chazon Ish told Ben-Gurion, that one day we will share the same vision and there will be no further questions. The meeting lasted just under an hour, and Ben-Gurion described it as warm, without overt zealotry. They got along really well. They even laughed together, he wrote. The office of the Prime Minister gave a rather muted statement to the press. Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion met privately with Rabbi A.Y. Karelitz, in parentheses it says, the Chazon Ish in Bnei Brak yesterday. The purpose of the visit was to exchange general views regarding the following issue. How can observant and non-observant Jews live together harmoniously in the state of Israel? The question of recruiting women to the army, known as Gizbanos, was not discussed, and the visit had no relation to current political matters. This, however, was not entirely true. As Melul explains, the Prime Minister made a gesture towards the ultra-Orthodox community by agreeing to continue the exemption of a limited number of Torah scholars from military service. As early as February 1948, before the State of Israel had even been formally established, a limited number of young ultra-Orthodox men were exempted from being drafted into the armed services, which were already fighting in what would come to be known as Israel's War of Independence. On January 9, 1951, the Prime Minister ordered the Israeli Army's chief of staff to exempt yeshiva students from regular service. Ben-Gurion's meeting with the Chazon Ish did not set the ground for the current ultra-Orthodox exemption from military service, but it did give the controversial early arrangement a substantial political boost and equally significant symbolic support. The Chazon Ish was certainly not the only rabbinic voice on the matter, though he undoubtedly held the most influence within the Haredi community. In 1948, an anonymous article was published advocating for all yeshiva students to serve in the Israeli army. The article has been attributed to Rav Yosef Shlomo Zevin, an incredible writer who we've discussed earlier, whose Zionist leanings were no secret. But most recently, Professor Mark Shapiro on the Svarim blog has questioned whether this article was correct attributed to him. As Shlomo Brody points out in his wonderful work, Ethics of Our Fighters, other rabbis, including Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and Rav Herzog, were much more supportive of conscription, even of yeshiva students, a fascinating story that involves Shar Yoshev Cohen. We may get to that later. Shar Yoshev Cohen was the brother-in-law of Rav Goren and the son, I believe, of the Nazir, of David Cohen, who was one of the chief students of Rav Cook. All of this for a different time. I just threw that in there parenthetically because they are fascinating personalities. Initially, Ben-Gurion allowed 400 exceptions offered to those studying full-time in yeshiva. This number was eventually doubled in 1975 by then then Minister of Defense Shimon Peres. It was only after the Likud's victory in 1977 when Agudas Yisrael's party made lifting the draft exemption numbers a condition for them joining Likud's governing coalition. By 1980, there were almost 10,000 exemptions. In 1998, a lawsuit, Rubenstein versus Minister of Defense, was brought before Israel's Supreme Court that challenged whether or not the defense minister did indeed have the authority to even grant such exemptions. The court ruled the defense minister had no such power to issue blanket exemptions and urged Knesset to propose new legislation. In response to the court's ruling, Prime Minister Ehud Barak tasked retired Israeli Supreme Court Justice, his last name is going to be familiar to many, Supreme Court Justice Tzvi Tal, to convene a commission that would propose new legislation. Jay Pollitzer, in his thesis, Peacemakers or Draft Dodgers, Haredi Resistance to Israeli Military Conscription, a fascinating master's thesis on this very topic, summarizes the results of the Tal law that were officially adopted in 2002. Its report began by recommending that yeshiva students' deferrals continue without a ceiling. These deferrals did, however, include a stipulation. Although 18-year-old yeshiva students would remain deferred, the Tal Commission recommended that these students take an optional decision year upon reaching the age of 22. During this year, yeshiva students would be free to enter the labor market or enroll in educational or vocational training without fear of being conscripted. After the decision year, it's so complicated, but I'm going to continue just because I never really totally made sense to me. After the decision year, yeshiva students could choose from one of three options. This is so complicated. First, these Haredim could return to their yeshivas and remain deferred. That's option one, after the decision year. Second, they could enlist in the IDF for a reduced term of service for 4 months, after which they would serve in the reserves, thus making them eligible to legally pursue employment. And then third, they could volunteer for 1 year of civil service, such as in paramedic or firefighting units or in local departments of social services, which would also permit them to work and free them of the prospects of being drafted. The proposals of the Tal law did not really succeed. Haredi enlistment did not markedly increase, and in 2012, the laws themselves were ruled unconstitutional by Israel's Supreme Court. Since then, and almost extraordinarily recently, the issue has remained in kind of this legislative limbo, all sorts of announcements, but that's already the news, and we're stepping out of the history. As the Haredi yeshiva system was debated within Israeli society, a different system for yeshiva learning was championed by the religious Zionist community known as Hesder, which literally means arrangement, whereby yeshivas made formal arrangements for the drafting of their students. Rav Yehuda Amital, who later founded Yeshivat Har Etzion, sometimes called the Gush, is generally credited with founding the movement. Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldwicht, who himself studied directly under, you guessed it, the Chazon Ish, created the first Hesder program in Yeshivat Keren B'Yavne. It really comes full circle. In 1981, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who served beside Rav Amital as Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshivat Har Etzion, wrote an article, again, this is 1981, The Ideology of Hesder, explaining the religious outlook of the movement. Characteristic of Rav Lichtenstein's general outlook and approach, the article is scholarly, substantive, but never strident or adversarial. He explicitly avoids any polemics with the yeshiva world. There are matters on which honest men of Torah can differ seriously out of mutual respect, Rav Lichtenstein writes, and I certainly have no desire to denigrate those who do not subscribe to my own positions. Instead, he argues that at the very least, Hesder should be seen as a legitimate path as any other. It is, to my mind, a good deal more, but surely not less. 10 years later, in 1991, on Yom HaAtzma'ut, the State of Israel awarded Rav Goldwicht the Israel Prize, Israel's highest honor, for his work pioneering the Hesder movement. As a student of the Chazon Ish, who dressed in traditional Haredi garb, he was an interesting choice to represent the Hesder movement, one that was not lost on many others. The citation that he received that day read in part, "The Hesder Yeshiva movement is an original and creative innovation developed in the newly established State of Israel to replace the centers of Torah learning destroyed during the Holocaust in Europe." Why, in fact, was the tribe of Levi not counted? Rashi provides two reasons. Given their exalted status, the legion of the king, and he literally uses the word legion, should not be counted separately. And number two, only those who were destined to die in the wilderness were counted. Since the tribe of Levi did not participate in the sin of the golden calf, they were spared and therefore not counted. Neither of these explanations, as Rav Herschel Schachter notes, seems to accord with the Rambam that gives a blanket exclusion for the tribe of Levi not participating in the army. Rambam, however, it makes sense why they were not counted, because they were not serving in the army, because they dedicated their life to study of Torah. And Rav Schachter shows, if you could look it up in both Rav Schachter on the Parsha and in Nefesh HaRav, that this question may come down to a reading in the Sifra, but we don't have to get to that now. Let's get back to the history, and we'll conclude with this. During World War I, British Chief Rabbi Joseph Hertz sent a letter to Rav Kook regarding his opinion on conscripting yeshiva students. Rav Kook, believe it or not, was vehemently opposed. No government can remove our sacred duty, Rav Kook writes in Igros Ra'ayayk, look in the third volume, letter, tough, Yud, that's 810. And later, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rav Kook's son, clarified to Rav Shar Yashav Cohen, who again, brother-in-law of Rav Gorin, that he assumed his father's words would not apply when Jews were actually fighting for their Jewish homeland. Still, everyone agrees the vital importance of continued Torah study for the future of the Jewish people. As Rav Lichtenstein explicitly acknowledges in his article, which discusses this very interpretation of the Rambam, the question is how many and from what community. His article ends with a prayer and will end with this. May God grant us a better station. In the meantime, however, if it is to become no worse, we must keep both our spirits and our guard up. Animated by vision and yet chary of danger, we of Yeshivot Hesder pray that he may grant us the wisdom and the courage to cope with the challenges of the time, fully appreciative of both the price we pay and the value of that which we safeguard in return. We approach our task with responsibility and humility, and impelled by both commitment to Torah and compassion for our people, we strive to fulfill it with a sense of broader spiritual and historical vision. Standing in tears atop Har HaZesim, the bleak site of Kol HaMekudesh Mechavero, Charev Yoser Mechavero. He is referencing, of course, the words of the Ramban that he wrote to his son, that whatever is holier will be destroyed even more. And he concludes with that saying, standing in tears atop Har HaZesim, the bleak sight of Kol HaMekudesh Mechavero, Charev Yoser Mechavero, stretching before him, what would the Ramban have given to head a yeshivat Hesder? So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors and friends, Janet and Lior Hode and family. With immense gratitude to Hashem, thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.